Hello, and welcome to the Phantasms of the Living podcast. I'm your host, the paranormal author and musician, Simon Thought, coming to you from New England, USA. I apologize for the very long delay between the last episode of this podcast and this one, but life gets in the way of death sometimes. I hope you understand, and I'll humbly ask for your forgiveness. As it's been a while, allow me to set the table again with a little background. This series covers case studies from the seminal two-volume massive work known as Phantasms of the Living, published in 1886 by the Society for Psychical Research in England. The Society was made up of both skeptics and believers in the paranormal and conducted research into various areas in an attempt to prove whether such phenomena were real or not. In the parlance of the Society, a phantasm was their term for a paranormal event. In the book, the authors explored about 700 case studies of such events, ranging from sightings of ghosts, premonitions of future events, telepathy, and more. They and their team from the Society then performed research to determine whether there was any truth to the story being told and whether they were corroborated by real events. This podcast will read those case studies and the results of the Society's research into them, then discuss them. This episode comes from Chapter 8 of Volume 1, which is entitled Dreams, meaning cases of paranormal events which appear to a person while sleeping, which are considered a link between impressions received telepathically and those directly observed. The authors put stock in dreams because those experiences were not tainted by conscious thought and were therefore more pure. They do not have to compete with reality and are just received as they are sent. This is distinct from those borderland cases we discussed in Episode 1. Unlike phantasms experienced while awake, which the observer easily remembers, dreams are fleeting and forgotten. As such, the authors say that they only report on dreams which were told to a third party or written down when they happened and before any corroboration of the dream's contents could be received by the dreamer. While the authors say that people dream millions of dreams each night, such that some may come true simply by chance, their research of this subject for 3 years, using a large group of subjects numbering 5,360 persons, showed that there were too many cases of dreams coming true to be mere chance, especially when the dream was very explicit and when the subject matter was from a unique event, such as death. The authors believe that, to a certain extent, these dreams were the receipt of telepathic signals at a time when the recipient's mind was sleeping and able to better receive them. Our case studies today are what the authors call examples of dreams which may be reasonably regarded as telepathic, being cases number 134 and 135, the first of which is long, but worth it. I want to give my usual warnings that being written in the 19th century, Phantasms of the Living has the more flowery, formal language one would expect from that era. However, I think it makes the stories more stately in their Victorian splendor. In a perfect world, the case studies would be told with a British accent, but I will not offend your senses by attempting that. You'll have to bear with my American voice. Quoting from Phantasms of the Living, "The next case is remarkable for the number of points of correspondence, though the dream is typically fantastic and confused. The narrative is from Mrs. Story of 8 Gilmore Road, Edinburgh. It was written by her, she tells us, the day or the day after the news of the fatal accident arrived, merely as a relief to herself, and without an idea of any further use. She prepared an account for us in the more finished form, but it seems preferable to give the original rough notes from which she was kindly allowed us to copy. The brother in this case was a twin with herself. Hobart Town, July 1874. Case number 134. On the evening of the 18th July, I felt unusually nervous. This seemed to begin with the occurrence of a small domestic annoyance about 8:30. When I went to my room, I even felt as if someone was there. I fancied, as I stepped into bed, that someone in thought tried to stop me. At 2:00, I woke from the following dream. It seemed like in dissolving views. In a twinkle of light, I saw a railway and the puff of the engine. I thought, what's going on up there? Traveling? I wonder if any of us are traveling and I'm dreaming of it. Someone, unseen by me, answered, no, something quite different, something wrong. I don't like to look at these things, I said. Then I saw behind and above my head William's upper half reclining, eyes and mouth half shut. His chest moved forward convulsively, and he raised his right arm. Then he bent forward, saying, I suppose I should move out of this. Then I saw him lying, eyes shut on the ground, flat, the chimney of an engine at his head. I called in excitement, that will strike him. The someone answered, yes, well, here's what it was. And immediately I saw William sitting in the open air, faint moonlight, on a raised place, sideways. He raised his right arm, shuddered, and said, I can't go on or back, no. Then he seemed lying flat. I cried out, oh, oh, and others to echo, oh, oh. He seemed then upon his elbow, saying, now it comes. Then, as if struggling to rise, turned twice round quickly, saying, is it the train? The train, the train. His right shoulder reverberating as if struck from behind. He fell back like fainting, his eyes rolled. A large dark object came between us like paneling of wood, and rather in the dark something rolled over, and like an arm was thrown up, and the whole thing went away with a whoosh. Close beside me on the ground, there seemed a long, dark object. I called out, they've left something behind, it's like a man. It then raised its shoulders and head and fell down again. The same someone answered, yes, sadly. After a moment, I screamingly called on to look up and said, is that thing not away yet? Answered, no. And in front, in light, there was a railway compartment in which sat Reverend Mr. Johnstone of Ucas. I said, what's he doing there? Answered, he's there. A railway porter went up to the window asking, have you seen any of... I caught no more, but I thought he referred to the thing left behind. Mr. Johnstone seemed to answer, no, and the man went quickly away. I thought to look for it. After all, this is the someone who said close to me, now I'm going. I started and at once saw William's back at my side. He put his right hand in grief over his face, and the other almost touching my shoulder, he crossed in front looking stern and solemn. There was a flash from the eyes, and I caught a glimpse of a fine pale face like ushering him along, and indistinctly another. I felt frightened and called out, is he angry? Oh no, is he going away? Answered, yes, by the same someone. And I woke with a loud sigh, which woke my husband, who said, what is it? I told him I'd been dreaming something unpleasant, named a railway, and dismissed it all from my mind as a dream. As I fell asleep again, I fancied the someone said, it's all gone. And another answered, I'll come and remind her. The news reached me 1 week afterwards. The accident had happened to my brother on the same night about 9:30. Reverend Mr. Johnstone and his wife were actually in the train which struck him. He was walking along the line which is raised 2 feet on a level country. He seemed to have gone 16 miles, must have been tired, and sat down to take off his boot, which was beside him. He dozed off and was very likely roused by the sound of the train. 76 sheep trucks had passed without touching him, but some wooden projection, likely the step, had touched the right side of his head, bruised his right shoulder, and killed him instantaneously. The night was very dark. I believe now that the someone was, from something in the way he spoke, William himself. The face with him was white as alabaster, and something like this, a small sketch was pasted thereon, in profile. There were many other thoughts or words seemed to pass, but there are too many to write down here. The voice of the someone, unseen, seemed always above the figure of William, which I saw. And when I was shown the compartment of the carriage with Mr. Johnstone, the someone seemed on a line between me and it, above me. In an account of Mrs. Story's on a page entitled July 1874, we find the 18th day marked and the words, Dear Willie died, and dreamed all of it, appended. The first letter from the Reverend J.C. Johnstone to the Reverend John Story, announcing the news of the accident, is lost. The following are extracts from his second and third letters on the subject. At Coos, 10th August, 1874. The place where Hunter was killed is on an open plain, and there was consequently plenty of room for him to escape the train had he been conscious, but I think Meldrum's theory is the correct one, that he had sat down to adjust some bandages on his leg and had thoughtlessly gone off to sleep. There's only one line of rails, and the ground is raised about 2 feet, the ground on which the rails rest. He had probably sat down on the edge and lain down backwards so as to be within the reach of some part of the train. It was not known at the time that an accident had occurred. Mrs. Johnstone and myself were in the train. Meldrum says he was not very much crushed. The top of the skull was struck off, and some ribs were broken under the armpit from one side. His body was found on the Sunday morning by a herd boy from adjoining station. August 29, 1874. The exact time at which the train struck poor Hunter must have been about 9:55 p.m., and his death must have been instantaneous. The above corresponds with the account of the inquest in the Riverine Herald for July 22nd. The Melbourne Argus also describes the accident as having taken place on the night of Saturday the 18th. The following remarks were taken from notes made by Professor Sidgwick during an interview with Mrs. Story in April 1884 and by Mrs. Sidgwick after another interview in September 1885. Mrs. Story cannot regard the experience exactly as a dream, though she woke up from it. She is sure that it did not grow more definite in recollection afterwards. She never had a series of scenes in a dream at any other time. They were introduced by a voice and a whisper, not recognized as her brother's. He had sat on the bank as he appeared in the dream. The engine she saw behind him had a chimney of peculiar shape, such as she had not seen at that time, and she remembers that Mr. Story thought her foolish about insisting on the chimney, unlike, he said, any which existed. But he informed her, when he came back from Victoria, where her brother was, that engines of this kind had just been introduced there. She had no reason to think that any conversation between the porter and the clergyman actually occurred. The persons who seemed to lead her brother away were not recognized by her, and she only saw the face of one of them. Mr. Story confirms his wife having said to him at the time of the dream, "What is that light?" Before writing the account first quoted, she had just mentioned the dream to her husband, but had not described it. She desired not to think of it, and also was unwilling to worry him about it because of his Sunday's work. This last point, it will be observed, is a confirmation of the fact that the dream took place on the Saturday night, and it came out clearly, Mrs. Sidgwick says, that her recollection about the Saturday night was an independent recollection and not read back after the incident was known. The strongly nervous state that preceded the dream was quite unique in Mrs. Story's experience. But as it appeared that, according to her recollection, it commenced at least an hour before the accident took place, it must be regarded as of no importance evidentially. The feeling of a presence in the room was also quite unique. Here the difficulty of referring the true elements in the dream to the agent's mind exceeds that noted in other case. For Mr. Hunter was asleep, and even if we can conceive that the image of the advancing engine may have had some place in his mind, the presence of Mr. Johnstone could not have been perceived by him. But it is possible, of course, to regard this last item of correspondence as accidental, even though the dream was telepathic. It will be observed that the dream followed the accident by about 4 hours. Such deferment is, I think, a strong point in favor of telepathic, as opposed to independent, clairvoyance. It really is easy to start your own podcast. It's an inexpensive and fun way to expand your reach and provide opinions and interests to others. Buzzsprout is the easiest and best way to launch, promote, and track your podcast. Your show can be online and listed in all the major podcast directories within minutes of finishing your recording. Podcasting isn't hard when you have the right partners, and the team at Buzzsprout is passionate about helping you succeed. Join over 100,000 podcasters already using Buzzsprout to get their message out to the world. Following the link in this show's notes lets Buzzsprout know we sent you, gets you a $20 Amazon gift card if you sign up for a paid plan, and helps support our show. We use Buzzsprout, and I can say it took no time at all to get this podcast out to you. I could not have done it without Buzzsprout's help. Podcasting isn't hard. You just have to know who to work with. Get out there and get talking now. As I said, our second case study is case 135, which involves injury to a relative from afar. To come, however, to a less abnormal case, the following account is from Mr. J.T. Millward Pierce, who has a cattle ranch in Nebraska. Blyville, P.O., Knox County, Nebraska, USA, December 5th, 1885, case number 135. I have just, or rather a month ago, had a very unpleasant accident which has fortunately turned out all right and has given me the pleasure of forwarding to you a very complete and unmistakable case of second sight. I think it better to enclose the two letters you find herein as I received them today. They are an answer to two of mine dated on the 2nd or 3rd, about a week after the accident. The accident occurred at 7 o'clock in the morning of the 26th of October. I fainted from loss of blood and was lying for a few moments on the ground. I was walking towards a pair of French windows with my hands in my pockets when I stumbled over a chair and fell right through the lowest pane of glass, face foremost, cutting my nose off on one side and nearly taking an eye out. So you will see my sister's dream was pretty accurate. I also enclose a statement made by two residents here of this end of the case, which will, I hope, make it complete. I may say our time is 6.5 hours ahead. He mistook for behind. England. Jonathan T. M. Pierce. Mr. Pierce enclosed the following statement. On Monday, October 26th, about 7 o'clock a.m., Mr. J. T. M. Pierce fell through a French window, cutting his face badly, and lay on the floor insensible for several minutes. J. Watson, C. J. Hunt. The enclosures from Mr. Payne's sister and mother are dated respectively November 15th and 17th, 1885. Miss Pierce, after condolences as to the accident, writes, "Do you know it is the oddest thing that on the 26th of October I dreamt that I saw you lying on the ground, quite unconscious, your face bleeding and looking so dreadful? I woke up calling to you. I told Kate directly I came down, and we both marked the date. I told Mother, too. I had had a bad dream about you, but I did not describe it for fear of frightening her. Was it not strange? It was such a vivid dream. It struck me very much. But I did not mention it in my last letter to you. I thought you would laugh about it. But it is strange on the very day, too." In Mrs. Pierce's letter, the following sentence occurs. "Was not May's dream singular? She came down that morning you were hurt and told Kate every particular of it, agreeing with the time you were hurt." In answers to inquiries, Miss Pierce writes, "Fretton's, Danbury, Chelmsford, December 31st, 1885. On the night of the 26th October, I dreamt I saw my brother lying on the ground, his face bleeding and dark. He was quite unconscious. I called to him, but he did not answer, and was stooping towards him, calling him by name when I awoke. It was so vivid a dream that it produced a great impression upon me, and I felt as though some accident had befallen him. I cannot tell at all what time in the night it was. In the morning, I told my sister and put down the date, also mentioning it to one or two others, but to my sister I described it in the same words that I have now used. I am not at all accustomed to having bad dreams about friends. Indeed, I never remember having had one before. Neither am I superstitious, but nevertheless, I felt convinced that something untoward had happened. So when the letter came just 3 weeks after the accident, I knew it was the confirmation of my fears. M. Pierce." The coincidence was not as close as Mrs. Pierce's words would imply, and she seems to have mistaken the morning on which the dream was mentioned. When Mr. Pierce was lying on the floor as described, the time of day at Chelmsford would have been between 1:30 and 2 p.m. Therefore, the dream on the following night must have been at least 8 hours, and may have even been more than 12 hours after the event. This refers to the deferment discussed in the last case. What do you think about these case studies? Are they just coincidence? If so, the dreams seem very accurately detailed for just coincidences. And the authors spent years with many people coming up with other similarly specific dreams, which were later proven to have described events which the dreamers could not have known at the time of the dream. That these dreams were corroborated by third parties and found to match the actual events which were dreamt about is hard to explain. As with all the phantasms of the living case studies which the Society scientists gathered and researched, we're faced with a number of questions. Whether they are proof of the paranormal, or evidence of some type of unconscious human connection, is still open to interpretation even over 130 years later. We now come to the end of another episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Simon Thought, and I wrote and produced it, other than the parts read from Phantasms of the Living itself, of course. Our theme song is called The Salad Bar, performed by my band Simon Thought and the Uploads. It's available on the usual music streaming platforms if you're so inclined. Any comments from listeners about what you think these case studies mean would be appreciated. You can also tell me your story of phantasms you've experienced. I may read what you send on a future episode. You never know. I can be reached by email at simonthoughtandtheuploads@gmail.com. I will review and discuss further case studies from Phantasms of the Living in future episodes, and I hope you will join me then. As a teaser, I recently came into the possession of an original first edition of the 1915 book True Ghost Stories by Dr. Harroward Carrington, which was renamed Phantasms of the Dead in its 1920 edition. Dr. Carrington was a paranormal scientist who worked as a research assistant for the Society for Psychical Research in England before going out on his own and writing numerous books on the subject. I will see about sprinkling some of those tales into this podcast in the future. Thank you for listening, and be vigilant. You never know when a phantasm will occur, so keep an eye out. Be well, and goodbye.